This is Artbreaker. As we are producing this episode of Artbreaker, 2020 doesn't seem to be shaping up as a great year. Maybe it'll turn around, and the hard work being put in by amazing people to reboot society, to rebuild better, will have paid off. But right now, I'm sure we could all use a nice dose of mid-20-teens nostalgia. Remember? The good old days. So let's get back there. Back before fear of pandemics.
The World Health Organization released a dire message today saying the Ebola virus is spreading fast and thousands more could die.
And civil unrest had us on edge.
We've just arrived at Causeway Bay, which is another of the Occupy protest sites.
And distracted from the important things. Like the winner of the Australian Open. Can't remember who won.
A few days over Roger Federer.
Neither could we. But to so many at the time, it seemed important. We'll save you Googling it. It was Stan Wawrinka. But you're not tuning into an episode of Artbreaker, the semi-regular series from the Climactic Collective that explores acts of creativity in the face of the climate crisis, to hear about sports. Or, if you are, you know something we don't. We don't have a sports show on the Climactic Network, at least not yet. But David Pocock is welcome to join us to launch one. Just drop us a line anytime, Dave. No. Today, we're going back in time to talk about the Australian Open of the arts world, an analogy that may offend members of both communities. We're talking about the 2014 Sydney Biennale.
With live performance, sculpture, video, and artistic experience, the Sydney Biennale promotes itself as the biggest contemporary arts festival in the Asia-Pacific region.
Specifically, the withdrawal of some artists from it, and how sometimes the most powerful thing an artist can do to spark change is not to show their art.
Art and protest have a long history. Here, though, the protest has overshadowed the art. It's a sign of how controversial Australia's refugee policy has become and in a thing or anyone to do with it. Andrew Thomas, Al Jazeera, on Cockatoo Island in Sydney.
Thanks, Andrew, and thanks, Al Jazeera, for the excellent introduction to Cockatoo Island and the Sydney Biennale. That's where the first half of our story today takes place. But it won't be the last, or even the last island. Today's story will take us to two more islands, famous ones, probably known to more Australians than Cockatoo Island, despite these not being in Sydney Harbour. This episode will talk about Manus and Nauru, about the refugee detention camps on these islands, and about the inhumane treatment and death of refugees and migrants kept there by the Australian government. Please be aware of this and be prepared for heavy content. But also, please keep listening. It's important to remember that while today's story takes us back 6 years, it isn't resolved. In May of 2020, protesters scaled the roof of the Mantra Hotel in Preston, northern Melbourne, to bring attention to the refugees being kept there within the building since July 2019. Today's story will talk about Australia's refugee policy, but it will be through the lens of the arts and from the perspective of one artist in particular, as she struggles to find a way to use the power of art to rise above critique and challenge to the level causing a real change. Let's introduce you to our setting for the start of this story, Cockatoo Island.
In March 1984, military brass gathered on Cockatoo Island for the launch of HMAS Success, then the largest Navy ship built in Australia. With the pull of a lever, Success was on her way, entering the water for the first time. Success was the last ship built at Cockatoo Island. The former convict prison was where many Australian warships and submarines were created.
This island was the main ship repair base in the Southwest Pacific.
But by the 1980s, it was in decline, and workers seized control on the island.
We want jobs! We want jobs!
Their jobs vanished when the dockyard was shut, workshops were demolished.
What price for this panorama? The federal government yet to decide what is to become of what is left of Cockatoo Island.
It was empty for a decade before being taken over by the Sydney Harbour Federation Trust. Festivals lured new visitors.
Cockatoo Island rocks!
Yeah!
And Hollywood came calling. Hugh Jackman's Wolverine was shot on the island. Today, the site is a tourist attraction. Visitors can learn about its heritage at a permanent exhibition.
It's a very diverse, complex story, but a fascinating story, and it tells really the story of Australia in many ways.
And since 2008, the Sydney Biennale had used Cockatoo Island as a venue. Ahead of the 2014 Biennale, a young artist was preparing for her first showing at this level.
So it was about 1 month before the exhibition was due to open. I had been working on this major new commission, a living garden full of flowers and plants that had bad connotations according to floriography books, like The Language of Flowers. And so I had sourced all these medicinal plants, some poisonous plants, things that have histories in medicine or in literature as having an ill effect or a negative connotation. The soil had shipped over, the garden beds had been made, and it was going to be at the apex, at the peak of Cockatoo Island in a former guard's residence that was just in ruins. So 1 month before the exhibition opened, I was at a conference on public art at the Footscray Arts Centre, and I heard a little ping on my phone. A friend forwarded me a blog post by this guy called Matt Kiam, who I'd never heard of before. He's a design teacher in Sydney. And he wrote that because of Transfield sponsoring the Biennale, and at the same time being involved in offshore immigration detention, he would not be taking his students to the Biennale this year. And he encouraged other people to do the same. I think I just froze. A wall went up. My two first thoughts were in complete conflict. I can't be involved in this, and I can't pull out.
So, to someone like Gabrielle, someone who's been paying attention to what's going on with the refugee detention centres, the deaths at sea, the abuses and human suffering, why didn't the news that the event was being sponsored by a company profiting from Manus and Nauru cause Gabrielle to immediately pull out? Well, they're a big deal for an aspiring artist. As Canada's state broadcaster, the CBC, explains, in this case about Venice Biennale, the premier arts event in the world, which Sydney can be a path to.
Remember that time your friend said, "Oh, I'm just so tired. The Venice Biennale was exhausting." And your uncle was like, "What's a biennaler?" And you stopped speaking to both of them forever. I'm Professor Lees, not really a professor, and this is Art 101, not really a class. And I'm here to clear up this Venice Biennale business right now. What is this word and what does it mean? And how do you pronounce it? And why is it such a big deal? The word Biennale itself is pretty simple. It's Italian and it just means every other year. Why does your friend say it in such an irritating way? Think of what Cannes or Sundance are for film, or what the Olympics is for sports. That's pretty much what the Venice Biennale means for art.
Not really knowing what my response was going to be, I called a couple of friends who I also knew were in the Biennale, and we decided to meet. And that began this really intense few weeks of interstate and international negotiations with a whole group of the artists who were involved, countless media appearances, improvised campaign tactics for people who had never done this kind of thing before, these makeshift strategies, and many, many sleepless nights.
Olafur Olafsson and Libya Castro are among the artists exhibiting. But at one point they withdrew, appalled that the event's main sponsor was to be the company running Australia's controversial camps for asylum seekers held in Papua New Guinea and Nauru.
Ethically, it was just impossible for us to continue in the exhibition knowing what we knew.
We felt we did not want to be an active part in this chain causing human suffering.
So we found all the contact details of as many of the artists as possible who were in the exhibition, And I should tell you here, I was definitely one of the small fish in this pond. Like, this was a step up for me, but there were some really big names in that exhibition. We were contacting people who were very hard to reach and represented by agents and gallerists and things like that. So we tried to get in contact with everyone that we could in the exhibition to invite them to be part of a discussion together as to what we could do collectively, how we could respond collectively. Over this conversation, there were lots of different strategies discussed. Maybe we should turn back the ferries full of arts patrons when they come to dock at Cockatoo Island. Maybe we should form a picket line at the opening reception and refuse to let people in. Maybe we could put together a public program that denounced Transfield and our government's actions alongside our work. Would that suffice? Or maybe we could each write a statement that we would put next to our wall labels. These would all allow us to make a strong statement and not lose out personally at the same time. We would also avoid having to let anyone down. We could still exhibit our work, basically, and send a strong statement. I was urged by lots of well-meaning people, journalists that I spoke to, art lovers, other artists, curators. I was told, make a work about it. That's what I was really good at. And that was my position. And thousands of people would see it if I just changed my work to make a comment about offshore immigration detention. That was my platform. The Biennale was my platform to make a political statement. And I shouldn't meddle in things that are too complex for an artist to possibly grasp.
But the more I thought about it, the more inevitable it became. The realization was upon me. There was nothing in the world that could justify my participation in the torture of refugees and asylum seekers.
As a group, we had publicised all our correspondence with the Biennale as we were going. And so there was a fair bit of media attention and public attention on the issue by the time the first group of artists came to withdraw. We did want it to become a matter that the broad public became interested in. And I believe that these are the kinds of ethical decisions that are around us every day. I hope that our situation becoming so public would bring to light how much agency people really have in collectively refusing to support unethical companies, unethical practices, unethical policies. So by the time I came to withdraw my work alongside four other artists, my understanding of how important it was had eclipsed my concern over the implications for my career. We were in communication at the time with people who were locked up on Manus Island, and they were front and centre of my mind at the time, and doing whatever I could to affect public opinion of this policy was really the most important thing.
Here's an excerpt from that statement from the 26th of February 2014. This is a statement of our withdrawal from the 19th Biennale of Sydney. We have revoked our works, cancelled our public events, and relinquished our artists' fees, while we have sought ways to address our strong opposition to Australia's mandatory detention policy as participants of the Biennale. We have decided that withdrawal is our most constructive choice. We do not accept the platform that Transfield provides via the Biennale for critique. We see our participation in the Biennale as an active link in the chain of associations that leads to the abuse of human rights. For us, this is undeniable and indefensible. Our withdrawal is one action in a multiplicity of others already enacted and soon to be carried out in and around the Biennale. We do not propose to know the exact ethical, strategic, or effective action to end mandatory detention. But we can act on conscience, and we act with hope.
If we then had an impact on the economic chains that supported this or on policy, then that would be even better. But I just wanted to do what I could. As we said in our letter, we We didn't purport to know the exact chain of events that would need to take place to dismantle this policy, but we were acting on conscience and we were acting in hope. I had organised to take my work down. It was on Cockatoo Island, which obviously is an island. It had been shipped over there by ferry in 2 8-ton trucks. I hired a truck to go and take the work down, and some friends came out of the woodwork and even strangers came out to kind of help me move these massive garden beds out of the ruins in which they were installed. I think I was so disappointed that it was all over. And the stress of those decisions and the kind of burden of expectation of the people whose interests we were acting for, and the kind of momentum that had been garnered in the art world around this sense of urgency that finally artists were in a position to actually do something, not just to comment on it, not just to make work about it, but we could actually leverage our position to make change. And so I felt all of that kind of flooding over me. But I think that alongside all of that, I knew without a doubt that I had made the right decision.
The decision was very unpopular among some circles. George Brandis, the Attorney General at the time, threatened to pull funding. Malcolm Turnbull publicly denounced our vicious ingratitude. Here's a clip from ABC's Q&A program from the time, with the government line from Susan Ley, now Australia's Minister for the Environment.
Well, our first question tonight comes from Rodrigo Salinas.
Thanks, Tony. My question for the panel is it fair or reasonable for the Minister for the Arts to seek to penalise arts organisations such as the Biennale of Sydney by threatening to remove public funding when these organisations decline to accept money from private donors that put them in a conflict of interest?
Let's hear from Susan Ley.
The arts challenge us, they invigorate us, and particularly in regional Australia, they matter a great deal. What George Brandis has said is he's asked the Australia Council to develop some guidelines. I think it's important to note in this case that Transfield, the parent company of Transfield Services, owns it's just a 12% stake that we're talking about. I think a couple of the artists, and I believe there's not many, are having a little bit of a tantrum about this. I think it's really important that we recognise the role of corporate philanthropy and look at the public interest test. Governments cannot always step in and fund everything. And if generous donors are prepared to do exactly that, then we should allow them. And there aren't strings attached to those corporate donations. They're made out of generosity. They're not saying to the artists, you must produce. And I really think that's important.
Senator Brand has actually written to the Australia Council asking it to come up with a policy to deny funding to events or artists who refuse corporate donations.
Let's wait and see what the Australia Council comes up with by way of policy. But
so
let's
are
remember.
Are you distancing yourself from that letter?
Not at all. No. A letter's been written. A policy will be developed. The Arts Minister will consider it. Lots of people will have their say. And in the middle of this, we've got to recognise that people who donate to the arts, in an era of scarce government funding, I think we all agree on that, should be recognised, supported, and where those funds are made by corporates, they don't need to be contributed by government.
By the time I had made the decision personally not to be involved in the Biennale and to withdraw my work, I knew that there were some other people who were about ready to withdraw their work like I was. So we decided to do it together to maximise that impact. And we also knew that there were some other people who were almost there. And so we were really careful not to put pressure on other artists to make a decision either way. Everyone had to go through their own personal journey of disconnection from what they had hoped for and what was the reality of the situation. Five of us. A week later, four more people were ready to withdraw their work, so they followed up with a following withdrawal statement. And by that point, international funding agencies had begun to get in contact with the Biennale and asked to withdraw their support of the exhibition. The news had really travelled quite far, and so the Biennale was experiencing a fair bit of pressure in terms of their relationship with Transfield and with Luca Belgiorno Nettis, who was the chair of the Biennale and also a director of Transfield Holdings.
And here's a section of a speech made by the director of Transfield in response to Gabrielle and other artists.
Step rather than see this Biennale significantly damaged by the action of activists and protesting artists. It is a great pity that the Biennale has been targeted by the activists and artists in such a destructive way rather than finding a more creative way. This episode is not good for the Biennale of Sydney, nor for the arts, or arts philanthropy more broadly. In saying this, however, I also compliment the activists and the artists for highlighting the difficult issue of asylum seekers and mandatory detention. This is a very important subject that needs a national discussion. This means we all need to come together and discuss potential solutions. Let the artists use the platforms like the Biennale to engage their audiences in these sorts of issues.
A lot of artists, arts patrons and curators were very much in support of withdrawing our work, but I do know that a lot of artists were angry with us, felt like we had done the wrong thing, felt that we had jeopardized the Biennale, that we had jeopardized other institutions from getting funding because companies would feel like it was too risky to work with arts institutions because of the negative backlash. And I think that all of that can only be seen as a positive. If companies are thinking that they can no longer buy their social license to operate via the reputation of the arts, then that can only be a positive thing. And companies with nothing to hide need not be afraid of investing in the arts. Only those who do have something to cover up and who do have activities that they need to kind of balance out with the good reputation of the arts need to be concerned about that. So I have heard accounts from as far as the ballet and the opera reflecting upon the Biennale boycott when thinking about sponsorships from companies like oil and gas companies or other companies involved in unethical practices. And I think it can only be a good thing that our actions have made both organizations, art organizations, and companies become more cautious about how they do their business. After having withdrawn my work from the Biennale, it was pretty much impossible for me to set off again where I had left. My understanding of the arts and of its position in the world had completely changed. It happened when I was considering the option of changing my work or making a new work in response to Transfield's participation in the detention regime. And it made me realize a few things about the way we see art, about different attitudes towards the power or the powerlessness of art. Thinking about what it would mean to make a new work and exhibiting it on the platform of the Biennale was a real eye-opener because it revealed to me the ways in which art can actually function to appease or conceal or distract from what is actually going on elsewhere. It made me realize that the reason why those suggestions were being made was because art is seen as anodyne. Culture is seen as decoration. Art is placed in museums, in institutions, it enters the art world, and it is tightly controlled within an inactive aesthetic realm. And anything that was radical or revolutionary or active dies. Arts institutions with its patrons and its stakeholders, its KPIs and OH&S, can powerfully deactivate the presence. If I had accepted all that well-meaning advice, it would have meant accepting our unshifting role as artists to provide cultural clout to a company that is committing atrocities for our government. And I didn't just want to criticize the art system or the social or political conditions under which we make art, I actually wanted to make change. And sometimes it actually cannot be done within art as we know it. It either has to happen outside art, or, as I would rather see it, the idea of artistic practice has to expand to become any activity that agitates in ways that other fields might not be able to. And I think this was the difference that I really had to examine in making my decision and afterwards as well. So I set out to find how I could make work that had the same disruptive potential as not making work. Because it was a pretty big surprise to me that the most impactful thing that I had done as an artist was to not make work. The problem with a victory of sorts, and I am calling it a victory, although it didn't dismantle the whole detention regime, it still made a significant impact on the economic viability of companies who are engaging with the government to provide services to torture adults and children. Problem with a victory is that we all felt pretty happy about it, and all of that momentum that had been garnered during the kind of crisis moment of the Biennale just dissolved. And so I found myself a year later at the anniversary of the death of Reza Barati, who was killed during protest on Manus Island.
Honourable Member for Melbourne.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. My question's to the Minister for Immigration. Minister, you said that you could guarantee the safety of refugees under Australia's care at Manus Island if they remain in the detention centre and act cooperatively. Given consistent reports that refugee Reza Barati was doing exactly that when he was beaten to death, isn't it now clear that your commitment is worthless and that you can't guarantee their safety? Or is the brutality at Manus simply another plank in your policy of deterring vulnerable people who are seeking our protection?
It is as tragic as the 1,200 other deaths that occurred over the last 5 years. All of those deaths were no less tragic than Mr. Barati. The children who died at sea, the some 8,000 who got on boats over the last 5 years, contractors that were present on that night, and soon after becoming the Minister for Immigration, I went to Manus Island, and one of the first things that presented to me was the issue of security in that compound. And as a result of that, we commissioned a force protection assessment review and started taking immediate steps to improve the security of that compound. And I believe the steps that we took over the ensuing 4 to 5 months saved lives on that night. Now, Madam Speaker...
And realising that we had dropped the ball. And so I started to try to bring people together to reactivate that spark, to reconvene and to refocus on what was important, how we could have an impact as artists. So in 2017, I created a symposium, which was part of the Climb Art Festival and under the program of a series of events that I co-direct called A Centre for Everything. It's around the intersection of art and politics and action. And out of this group, there formed the Artists Committee.
My name is Gabrielle De Vietri. I'm an artist and a member of the Artists Committee. I believe that the role of art is to critique society and the world that we live in.
The Artists Committee started looking at the institutional relationships that cross over with the fossil fuels industry and the detention industry.
As artists, our united voice against the inhumane treatment of asylum seekers and refugees has been heard loud and clear. We now ask the NGV to act boldly in the interests of human rights, and as a state cultural institution, show moral leadership on this major issue.
And while we were working on a project looking at the sponsorship of the Melbourne Museum by Rio Tinto, which is a mining and resources company, we received information about the National Gallery of Victoria having begun a contract with Wilson Security, active in the detention centres on Manus Island and Nauru, and who had been uncovered as being responsible for a whole host of absolutely horrific abuses.
The Manus MP condemned the actions by the Wilson security officers and the process authorities took by sending the suspects back to Australia.
The way Transfuel has handled this thing is deplorable. We demand him Australian High Commission, Border Protection from Australia and Immigration, bring those three people back and let the police deal.
All sorts of men, women and children on Manus Island and Nauru. And here was our respected state art gallery undertaking a new contract with this company that had proven itself to act in the most horrific, unethical ways. And so we quickly shifted our attention and began to work on a way in which we could make art that would intervene in that space, that would bring public attention, not just a kind of severing of ties, but actually use our skills as theatre makers, as filmmakers, as costume makers, image makers, to create an image. And so we decided to focus on one of the National Gallery of Victoria, the NGV's most prized works of art.
This is The Weeping Woman. In acidic green and purple, the painting portrays a woman convulsed by grief. It was painted 4 months after Picasso's most famous political work, Guernica, and it was forged from the same horrific subject matter, the infamous German attack on the ancient Basque city during the Spanish Civil War.
This was the first Picasso that the gallery had ever acquired for, at the time, $2 million, I believe. It's now worth over $50 million. It is an extract from Guernica, which is that horrific painting that Picasso painted of the Spanish War, which was made in order to remind people of the horrors of war and the kind of extent of human suffering that could occur, to kind of urge them to never again commit such atrocities. And so the Weeping Woman was this kind of emblem of human suffering. And we found it particularly jarring that this painting of human suffering was being guarded and looked over by the same people, the same company who were actually perpetrating these crimes against humanity elsewhere in the world.
Activists have shrouded a prized Picasso painting in a black veil at the National Gallery of Victoria in protest.
20 or so of us came together and decided that we would shroud the Weeping Woman in a cloth which would have the Wilson Security logo on it, and that we would guard this painting from the atrocities of Wilson Security.
Artist Gabrielle De Vitri said the group draped the fabric over the painting, taped it to the wall and stood in front of it before guards could intervene. We reassured them there was no intention to damage the artwork or do any harm or hurt anyone. The activists want the gallery to immediately dump its contract with Wilson Security, accusing the company of covering up human rights abuses at the offshore detention centres and profiting
from people were not allowed to enter to view the spectacle, although the people who were already there were kind of shut in with us. And media came and documented the event. Obviously, the director came to see what was going on.
Wilson Security declined to comment.
Now, we only took this step after having exhausted all the kind of more acceptable, more civil ways of doing things, which was to have a meeting, to write a petition, which was signed by over 1,500 members of the arts community. We had made these kind of public statements and implored the gallery to reconsider their relationship. And we knew that this contract was movable because it was at a junction in time where the gallery was considering a new provider, and that this one was a kind of a probationary contract of sorts that would be extended after 3 more months. So we knew that we had a really opportune moment to intervene. That was one of the interventions, and we ended up doing 3 more, and we had become quite public by the end about our intentions to intervene in that space. And I think by the third, the gallery had become quite sick of it. And knowing that there would be a whole host of other organisations involved in the next one that we had planned, they wrote to us quietly and told us that they would no longer be dealing with Wilson Security, and so we could step back in terms of our plans for another agitation. That to me really showed how we could leverage our skills as artists, not just our public position, but the way that we do things as artists, to step in and make change.
Gabrielle didn't return to the career path she was on, leading up to the Sydney Biennale in 2014. And that path seemed like it was a promising one, towards a bright future in the arts. But earlier this year in an event by ClimArt and as part of his world tour for the Bark Project, Gabriel joined Yo-Yo Ma, the most celebrated instrumentalist of a generation, on a panel about climate activism in front of a room of students. She shared her thoughts, now looking back on the road she chose and advising the next generation.
Hear now from Gabrielle at ClimArt's recent Melbourne Forum on Climate Action, a collaboration with Yo-Yo Ma's Bach Day of Action.
I used to make work as an artist which was whimsical, poetic commentary on the human condition. I made relationship contracts presented in a filing cabinet in a gallery. I invented a three-team footy game. I created a catalogue of ideas. And my career was on an upward trajectory. Then, a few years ago, I was invited to exhibit at the Sydney Biennale. I had 2 years to make the work of a lifetime. This was my big break. Who knows what would happen next? Maybe the Shanghai Biennale or Istanbul Biennale, Venice even. Skip forward 2 years and the opening day was fast approaching. My work had been shipped in 2 8-ton trucks onto Cockatoo Island just out of Sydney and it was almost finished. Then I discovered something. The sponsor, the main sponsor of the Biennale, was negotiating a contract with the Australian government to take over the operation of the detention centres on Manus Island and Nauru. This is where thousands of adults and children are imprisoned in horrific conditions just for seeking safety in Australia. After meetings and discussions and many sleepless nights, I withdrew my work alongside 4 other people. Before the show had even opened. We made sure it counted. We made sure that the media, public, that Transfield and the Australian government were talking about it. Then 4 more artists withdrew their work. George Brandis, the Attorney General, threatened to pull funding. Malcolm Turnbull denounced our vicious ingratitude. Those were his words. But we did the right thing. The chair of the Biennale and the director of Transfield resigned. He took his family's money, 11% of the company, out of Transfield, and he revoked the right for them to use the Transfield name and logo. They were forced to change their name to Broad Spectrum. Superannuation funds divested from Transfield. Their share prices plummeted. Announced shortly afterwards that they would no longer service the detention centres at the earliest opportunity. This experience fundamentally altered my understanding of what art can and should do. I became aware of how complicit we are in the destruction of humanity and of the environment just by participating in things that seem innocuous or beneficial even. And it shook me to the core that the most significant thing that I did with my art was to withdraw it. As an artist, I wanted to know, does art have the potential to change the injustice in the systems that we inhabit? Does it have the potential to truly transform society, to interrupt the economics of business as usual? What are the choices that we're making every day to challenge or endorse the status quo? I formed an artist activist group called the Artist Committee to test these ideas. We shrouded Picasso's Weeping Woman to draw attention to the National Gallery of Victoria's contract with human rights abusers, Wilson Security. A single cellist played a song composed by filmmaker, writer and Manus Island detainee Behruz Buchani. And the arts play a really important role in art washing some of the most unethical and polluting companies of the world. This year I created a network map that shows the countless connections between our major arts institutions and some of the most polluting companies. The companies that contribute the most towards climate change are all cozy with our major arts organisations here in Australia. Chevron, ExxonMobil, BHP, Woodside. They attach themselves
to the ballet, the opera, the orchestra, the visual arts. They attach themselves to the things we love most, because if we bring them down, we will think that we have to bring down the things we love too. We have so much work to do in this field, and I'm still working out how to do that. For the rest of my time, I'd like to play a game with you. It's called Stand Up, Sit Down. It's very simple. I'm going to say some statements, and if you feel that these statements resonate with you, if you agree with them or they sound like you, I want you to stand up. And if they don't, if you don't agree with them or they don't resonate with you, I want you to sit down. And, of course, there's always the option to hover, okay? So if you stand up, if you believe that art is a powerful unifier of people from all walks of life. Okay, sit down. Stand up if you believe that art is elitist and exclusive. You can believe both things at the same time, that's fine. Art is full of contradictions. Stand up if you quietly panic about climate change on most days. Okay, sit down. Stand up if you think that our response as a community to climate change is appropriate to the scale of the crisis. That encapsulates my response exactly. Stand up if you think that the arts help us imagine a better future. Stand up if you believe that art can distract us or conceal from what is going on elsewhere. Two more. Stand up if you think that when it comes to art and social change, a conversation is more important than a spectacle. I'm a hover for that one. Yeah. Stand up if you feel that your potential to be part of change is being fully exercised. Now, the last thing I'd like you to do is to quickly, because we don't have much time, talk to the person next to you about something that you would like to get involved in or start to be part of the solution. Go.
Okay. That's a good cover.
Yeah.
Maybe joining other...
I wonder if any of you decided to invite your friends around for an afternoon tea and letter writing to your MP. Or maybe it was to join one of the many climate action groups working in lots of different ways to hold power to account. Or to petition your local shop on packaging. Maybe you organise a river cleanup. Or maybe you're going to start a blockade of BHP in Melbourne. Any one of you can do any of those things. If you're a minor, I'm not giving you permission. But, you know, there is no need to seek permission. And no one is going to give it to you anyway. And I know a lot of you are already doing the incredible and exhausting work that needs to be done. So thank you. Continue to be bold, be thoughtful, and never assume that someone else is going to take care of it. As much as I think we probably all love her, we all know that Greta is not going to fix it by herself. And with all due respect, neither can someone as incredible as Yo-Yo Ma. We need to do this together. Thank you.
Thanks to Bronwyn Johnson at ClimArt for the use of the recording.
But there's only so much that you can criticise an industry and remain within it. And so the more I worked on these issues and the more I kind of uncovered the systemic wrongs that we participate in as artists, the less I became able to continue to participate in them. It was a long journey from 2014 to 2020, but eventually that way of thinking and that position that I occupied in the art world became untenable, and it led me to reconsider what I was doing. With all the energy and the skills and the understanding of how things work that I had, and I felt like all of those qualities could be actually better placed somewhere else. So now here I am, and I'm studying law, and I'm about to put myself forward as a potential candidate in the next council elections. And I feel that the impact that I'm having as a paralegal at Refugee Legal, for example, and in the future to be able to enact change in terms of policy and strategic litigation in the areas of environment and human rights, that those areas are places where I can be really purposeful and really directed and really specific about the change that I want to make, instead of being involved in an industry where change making is just incidental. In this way, it will be really the kind of central purpose of what I'm doing. So watch this space.
So don't look to the arts as the source of all the answers, or where we will find the power we need in order to make a better world, or to save us in the face of climate crisis. Don't look to the purity of expression of the creative arts, the rarefied atmosphere of fine arts. Don't look to the law, or politics for that matter, because none of these disciplines contain all the answers. Instead, look to your gifts, harness them, and act with purpose. Be bold enough to say no when that's the right answer. And don't let yourself get stuck in the mud while chasing your dreams. The arts community is going through some of the hardest times in living memory, and many working artists may have to turn to other ways to support themselves. We hope Gabrielle's story is timely and encouraging, and shows you that there is no such thing as a former artist. Simply, an artist who's bringing their artistic mind to their vocation. During this pandemic, and then the painful recovery, we'd like to offer Artbreaker as a platform for sharing the stories of resilience and purpose that will get us through these times and the next, as we face the true struggle of the climate and biodiversity emergency. Please get in touch to work with us to share more stories like Gabrielle's. Thank you for listening. I've been your host, Marty. I run a sound studio in Alexandria in Sydney called Echidna Audio. Yes, like the small spiky animal. I'm on Insta, Facebook, and you can check out my website, echidnaaudio.com. Mark Spencer produced this episode, and we'd like to thank Gabrielle Devietri for sharing her story. Kat and Bronwyn from Climart for making the connections, and Pushka for the music in this episode. You can find them on Bandcamp, SoundCloud, or Facebook. Check out Pushka's latest release on Bandcamp, Echo La Lia. We'll be back with another episode soon, but until then, take care of each other in these climactic times.